Welcome to the Food and Farming Podcast from AHDB, keeping levypayers informed and at the heart of the conversation.
Hello and welcome to AHDB's Food and Farming Podcast. I'm Katie Evans, Senior Knowledge Exchange Manager on the Beef and Lamb team and AHDB's National Specialist for Grass Forage and Soil. Welcome to this podcast about clover and how it has a significant role in enhancing soil health, promoting biodiversity, and in optimizing livestock production. We will share with you some of our expert tips and real-life stories on establishment and management of both the white and red clover. I was recently joined by Research Officer Nicky Byrne from Chagas in Ireland and James Drummond from Leamington Hill Head Farm in Northumberland. We began our chat with some introductions, starting with Nicky.
Firstly, I'm a livestock systems research officer, so I'm looking at the use of the most appropriate animal genetics and the most appropriate way to feed those animals in terms of a forage-based diet in order to optimise, you know, the production efficiencies, reduced age of slaughter, the use of concentrates and nitrogen in our farm systems. So we're especially interested in the use of forage legumes, such as, you know, red and white clover in terms of reducing our nitrogen inputs into our farm system, and as well as increasing animal performance and, you know, displacing the need for expensive concentrate, you know, into our system. So ultimately, the use of forage legumes is, you know, improving our economic and environmental efficiency. And we're really focused, you know, especially in terms of a beef system, in improving our nitrogen use efficiency. You know, we're probably at the moment, you know, in before we incorporated in clover, we're kind of down around 20 to 22% nitrogen use efficiency, whereas we know with efficient dairy production systems, they're up at maybe, you know, mid 30s to 40% in some cases. So really, we're focused on improving the use of nitrogen in our system, and forage legumes can do that.
James, do you want to introduce yourself, some of the research that's been done on your farm and what work you've been involved with? And again, same question to you. How does clover feature on your farm, and what are the benefits that you're seeing?
Thanks for having me. We're a forage-based livestock farm up in Northumberland. We're sheep and beef, and really got into our pasture management over the last 10 years or so here. Very heavily driven by the use of legumes. With the improved grazing management we got, the improved utilization of pasture, we've doubled the livestock this farm's carrying, and a lot of that has been based around legumes. We're not increasing our inputs. We don't want to. We're trying to reduce nitrogen feed from our system. We don't want to have them volatile input costs. We want nitrogen coming naturally from the plants we grow. So we're very heavily data recorded here. We breed for a genetics company. Everything's tagged at birth. We've got big data sets. So anything we're doing seed mix wise, rotation wise, entry cover wise, we've got quite robust data to look at actually how we've developed the system here. And we've also been involved in quite a bit of trial work within the industry. So we've helped develop some seed mixes for a few companies. We've been using herb legume base pastures, so on top of just the legumes, the legume plus, for sort of 10 years now, and really developing what we do on farm with them. And we've been part of something called the Super G project. So that's a sustainable permanent grassland project, looking at basically the integration of legumes and herbs into permanent grassland systems.
So thank you both. Just going to dive straight in with some of those technical questions, because we've loads to cover and I'm sure we'll have lots of questions and discussion as we go along. So first one's over to you, Nicky. Can you give us some insight into some of the key benefits of incorporating clover into the sward, and what are the capabilities of it once it is established?
Yeah, so I suppose in terms of the main benefit of incorporating clovers into our spores, and especially red clover, perhaps in terms of my own research experience, the big benefit is for those legume plants, you know, to fix high levels of atmospheric nitrogen and make a plant ready available, you know, to other plants growing within that sward. So it can take nitrogen out of the atmosphere, and make it available to other plants growing from the sward. So there's a very much a symbiotic relationship there between those legumes such as red and white clover and the grasses that, that grow in the sward. And as well as that, we know, you know, there's certain, you know, improvements in terms of the sward nutritive value from incorporating in our legumes. And also, as well as improved nutritive value, we've probably higher intake capacity from these legume-rich forages. So a combination of better quality and higher intakes of a better quality feed will result in higher levels of animal performance, be it live weight gain on growing cattle or lambs, or be it milk production from the dairy cow. So that's driven by higher quality feed, higher intakes of it. And especially if we look at the red clover in terms of a silage sward, you know, we know that we can get that high intake potential, but we also have, you know, a much higher concentration of nitrogen or crude protein available in the plant. But we, what we have is a protein that's of higher quality that will not degrade in the rumen of the animal, and more of it will go through to the abomasum and be absorbed in the small intestine of the animal and can be diverted more efficiently into growth or milk production. So it really does, you know, it can produce more feed of a higher quality, and get higher intakes on our animals without the need of extra inputs into our farm systems. So really what we've found from our experience from red clover incorporation into our intensive dairy bee system, we've reduced our inputs, we've dropped 100 kilos of nitrogen per hectare off our farm system, but at the same time, we've increased animal performance. So that's really, really important. You know, we've now a dairy beef system that can produce in excess of 1,000 kilos of carcass through the use of the appropriate animal genetics and the incorporation of forage legumes into our pastures and into our indoor diets as well.
Nicky, you've mentioned that these are the kind of results that you're seeing off red clover mixed swards. What are you seeing, or what would you think would be the result when you're looking at the white clover swards? And what kind of percentages of clover in the sward would you need to see to have that significant nitrogen production?
Yeah, so I suppose, look, your clover percentages vary, you know, a lot throughout the year. But I suppose if we are to see, you know, those benefits coming through from the white clover within the sward, we certainly need to be getting, you know, an excess of 20 to 25% on a dry matter basis across the year to get that sward dry matter production benefit, as well as an animal performance benefit, be it with dairy cows or beef cattle, you know. So in order to get those kind of percentages, you know, we have to be very cautious about how we manage the sward. So in terms of soil fertility, you know, given an appropriate P and K levels, maintaining a high pH, you know, between 6.3 and 7. And as well as that, the grazing management. You know, we want to reduce the competition from the grass, allow light down to the clover plant to encourage a high proportion of that throughout the year. Because the higher the clover content of the sward, the more nitrogen we're going to fix and the more herbage production we're going to produce on the back of that.
Brilliant. And we'll be drilling down, excuse the pun, into that kind of that establishment and management practices that kind of help with the establishment and the germination rates, but also the persistency through the season and years to follow. While visiting the Moor Park Open Day, one of the things that really stood out to me on the grassland village was looking at the, I suppose, the nutrient management and that sort of the application of nitrogen to some of those clover swards early on in the season. Can you kind of talk us through very briefly before, because we will touch on it later on in the podcast, but why we're applying nitrogen at those times, or why we, I say more yourselves, why are you applying it to a crop where who I always imagined was quite a lazy crop, in the sense that if we're applying nitrogen to it, was it going to fix and establish itself to produce nitrogen efficiently afterwards?
Yeah, so if we take, say, my own experience, so taking a lot of the Chagas research, we bring forward that and put it into our farm system experiments that we run. So if we look at Johnstown Castle, where we have a dairy beef clover system alongside a grass only and a multi-species farm systems as well. If we look at the dry matter, the demand for dry matter on our farms, you know, it can be quite high early on in the springtime. And we know that, you know, over the winter months, we probably do get a lot of clover melt, and we start out with a really, really low proportion of white clover at the start of the year. And we may find that, you know, we may not have enough herbage available on those clover swards, you know, early on in the spring. So we can see that by front loading the nitrogen to early on in the year, where we very low proportions of white clover, we probably do get a response, because we need to grow herbage and make it available in early spring. And we have a low proportion of clover. So we do, you know, have a role for front loading somewhat that chemical nitrogen application early on in the year. But as we go through the summer months and we start, you know, getting increase in levels of white clover in the sward, you know, we can reduce and skip or eliminate some of that for chemical nitrogen inputs out of the system. So we probably reduce maybe more so than skipping in our own farm systems. But then at peak months, say from the middle of June onwards, when we have a high level, you know, in excess of 30% of the sward been occupied by white clover, we probably eliminate it out of our dairy beef systems. So look, it's all about working with the clover. We want to keep low pre-grazing herbage masses to allow light into the sward to encourage a high level of clover. But if we continued with nitrogen application through the summer months, you know, the clover may well become redundant. It won't have a role there in terms of fixing nitrogen. Mm-hmm. It'll become lazy, and we'll see, you know, a reduction in stolen mass and the development of new stolen lands, you know, throughout the year. So if we don't trust in the clover and demand it to do its job, you know, it'll become lazy in the sward, and eventually, you know, will die out somewhat.
And there has been research done on this. And for our listeners, what I'll do is I'll include a link at the end of the podcast script so that people can look in and read up more on some of the biomass that's produced off some of these research plots. So, James, some of your motivations on including clover in your pasture comes down to quality and improving soil health. Do you want to just talk through some of the other benefits you associate and why you've incorporated clover into so many of your swards at home?
I think I might contradict a few things that I've been listening to from Nikki. One of the main benefits we have clover for is to drive our pasture-based system, so we're not reliant on volatile input costs. So we want to try and eliminate as much nitrogen use as possible, and we're doing a pretty good job of doing it whilst producing a lot more forage. So one of the main benefits there of the legumes is to fix nitrogen, and obviously there's a seasonal variation in the timing when that starts in the season, but we very much want to match our pasture growth curve on farm with our stock demand. So some of that's just a management issue there to make sure we're not needing to front load quite as much, and we can defer grazing earlier on for pre-laminar rotations and stuff. So we can play around with the management of our pasture as a whole on farm to have a lower cost of production system. When we look at the profitability of most farms, the biggest correlation is cost of production versus profit. So if we can concentrate on having a pasture-based system that reduces them, I'm not going to say unnecessary, sometimes they are a necessity, but the reliance on as many input costs, it makes our farm system more resilient, and definitely in more struggling times recently with droughts and so on, resilience is a big focal area really for us going forward. So yeah, there's great benefits in the legumes in our system, and also to the soil. We want to look at the biological activity of the soil. I rent this farm. I'm hopefully going to be renting a little bit more soon. I essentially pay for pasture, but the soil underneath it. So I don't want to be spending far too much money on chemicals and physical things that are going to disrupt their properties in the soil. I want to try and enhance the biological function of my soil to help get as much money as that as I can from that rent, really. And yeah, like, these legumes are so important going forward. Legumes are there in so many pastures. The amount of old permanent pasture that just through improving the grazing management, the legumes have really come through. Nikki mentioned before, basically giving them light, like a good rotational grazing system, take that biomass off the top, give the clover some light. It's amazing how much just naturally comes through in these pastures. Admittedly, that's reducing the sprays, reducing the fur applications a bit as well, things that are going to hinder that clover and make it lazy. But quite often the clover's there, we just need to give it a chance and let it do its thing, and that can start helping driving the pasture system. But certainly the things that we're seeing, like Nikki touched on, that improved nutrient content of the pasture available, that's having a huge effect on daily live weight gain, days to slaughter, improved performance and growth in our ewe lambs towards mating, so better scanning percentages in them. It's just the quality of that forage. I think, is it 4 to 6 hours for really high quality forage to go through that animal? If they're eating sort of tall rank stuff, it can be up to 3 days. Obviously that nutrient intake, the animal is massively reduced, and the knock-on effect on how long it's on farm and how much money you waste on that animal. So yeah, graze quality and graze clover, you're going to help push that system a fair bit.
One of the things I suppose farmers are having to really address at the moment through the likes of carbon auditing, and that is carbon footprint on farm. How do you see, and I know you've already touched on it, the role of clover in reducing those inputs like fertilizer and the costs associated with it, but what other benefits along there when you're looking at those results from the likes of your carbon audit that you see clover is benefiting? Things maybe like the homegrown proteins and so on.
Well, yeah, you're not buying in the feed. If you're concentrating on a grazing system, you're not buying in feed, you're not buying in fertilizer or burning too much diesel, and you have the system in place. If you're feeding silage, bale grazing, so you're not tearing around all winter and tractors and stuff, making a mess and making emissions for no reason. So yeah, the big one is that day on farm, isn't it? Just reducing the net emissions per animal. There's quite a lot actually can be done in looking at improving production efficiency in the animal. So actually, if you start pulling your rearing percentage up, you're dropping that days to slaughter. When you start looking at your audits, that's really having a big effect there. The other thing is there's legumes we can grow other than clover that could potentially have quite a big impact. We use a lot of condensed tannins here in our pastures to initially was to counter bloat. So if we're getting intestinal torsions, red gut, a few different phrases for in sheep particularly, we were putting the condensed tannins. So that was Beresford trefoil, predominantly chicory, the sandfoin, but poor persistency. Having these species in the pasture is initially reducing our losses, but there's also potential there to start reducing the methane output of them animals. I've just started 10 days of putting lambs through methane chambers. We might know a bit more in 10 days time. We might not. Could be a long time to actually see the results here. There's genetic variation with animals we can start pulling apart and identifying. But certainly that, yeah, improved performance, reduction on inputs, that's going to have a big impact in your carbon audits.
Nikki, is there anything you'd like to add to what James has said?
Our own experience in terms of legumes, you know, they're going to have, you know, a beneficial impact, especially on that methane production from those animals. Because if we think about the way that, you know, that enhanced sward quality will work, it'll increase the overall digestibility of rice. We'll have more digestible strains of fibre coming through. We'll get, you know, more rapid passage rate from these high quality diets as well. So all of those factors coming together can, I suppose, somewhat reduce the intensity of methane production from these forage legume diets. If we just take, for example, over the last winter on our dairy beef weanlings consuming red clover silages, you know, they actually produced the exact same grams of methane per day. So your typical dairy beef weanling, about 156 grams of methane per day from perennial ryegrass versus a perennial ryegrass plus red clover. But if we take into account the differences in dry matter intake, those animals on red clover consumed about 28% more dry matter on a daily basis, yet they still produced the exact same yield of methane. So if we look at it, the intensity of methane per kilo of dry matter intake was reduced because of those improved nutritive value characteristics of that red clover incorporation. And look, the same can be said for the grey sward containing a white clover. You're going to get the same type of benefits and reduction in methane production intensity. And as well as that, when we look at it on a farm system basis, where we eliminate fertilizer and feed out of the system, it's going to have a huge, huge impact on the carbon intensity per kilo of product or at farm gate level. So it's going to be a huge, huge factor. And that's why we've brought forward legumes into our system. We've optimized them in every other capacity, but we're still locked in because of our high stocking rates and our grass-based system. We were still locked into using a lot of chemical nitrogen. So we wanted to see how can we reduce this. And, you know, red clover for our silage swards and white for our grazing swards were the two most easily adapted options that we could identify.
So we've just gone through a significant list of benefits there on having clover on farm. But now we're on to the tricky part, which is actually getting it established successfully. And what are the key areas that we need to focus on and take into consideration to achieve that successful germination and establishment? It's also worth flagging here, maybe for Nikki's sake, that there are now in the UK very few options for weed control in forage legumes, even for key species like white clover, red clover and lucerne. So key herbicide products have been lost for various reasons. And as you can imagine, this is making weed control in clover-based lays a major challenge. Currently, the recommendations, what I've heard from farmers, is that they're sowing only grass species into new lays or reseeds so that herbicides can then be used to control broadleaves and then introduce clovers at a later date. And this isn't always possible, and it's not a reliable way, maybe, or the most reliable way of establishing red or white clover in swards. So taking what I've said into account, Nikki, can you advise when is the best time to start establishing clover on farm and why? What are those targets, drivers or sort of, I suppose, areas, whether it's weather, soil temperature, that would make our decision making a lot easier when deciding what to put into the ground?
Yeah, so I suppose, look, Ireland is probably somewhat different, and you know that the recommendations may vary based on agroclimatic region, soil type, etc. So if we just take, look, in Ireland, we probably find spring reseeds are the most reliable in terms of incorporating white clover into the sward. Look, we're still fortunate enough that we do have some of those clover safe sprays to get early control of broadleaves. And that's, you know, that is probably really, really important in terms of incorporating white clover. You know, if we lose those, you know, it will act as a deterrent for farmers in incorporating legumes into their reseeding program. But we would find spring reseeds, you know, offer you the best balance of having appropriate soil temperatures, appropriate soil moisture, and the conditions, you know, to incorporate red clover or clovers into the sward. I suppose oversowing is becomingly more and more important, you know, to increase the proportion of white clover on our farms. And I suppose Mike Egan is conducting a lot of on-farm research at looking at, you know, the various methods of oversowing and their success rates. And one of the key findings, you know, that they're probably seeing popping up on farms where they're getting very, very high levels of success with oversowing is oversowing paddocks in the month of April. And the thinking behind that is that the month of April has the appropriate temperature, enough moisture to get the crop established, and enough moisture, you know, that you're not running into a drought that you might hit in late May or early June, that you have enough, probably have a root developed at that stage that it can withstand, you know, a limited moisture content. But one of the big things that's really important is reducing the competition of the grass and these already established swards from, you know, shading out the clover that has been stitched in into the sward. So grazing at relatively low covers, reducing nitrogen inputs as well into that sward, and, you know, maximizing the light that gets down into that. And another thing that's popping up in a lot of these farms that have a good success rate is soil pH. You know, soil pH is probably up close to 7, you know, is probably where we're seeing really, really good uptake of clover in the swards. And I suppose if clover isn't persisting in your swards, you have to go back and look at a couple of the managements. What's your grazing management like? And what's your nutrient management? You know, there's reasons behind, you know, these legumes burning out of the sward. So you need to correct some of those, you know, prior to re-establishing it. So your P and K levels, as well as your soil pH.
Thanks, Nicky. I suppose one of the things that we're seeing, and we're seeing the coming through, especially on like our Forage for Knowledge data, are the effects of those colder springs that we're experiencing here. In that case, from what you've just said, would it maybe suit better us considering more awesome seed, early awesome seed reseeds? Or do you think there's still time in the likes of April there to be establishing?
Yeah, I suppose probably the month of August probably does have maybe some similar conditions, perhaps to your April and May reseeds to get it in. And look, the autumn reseeds probably are maybe easier in terms of your feed budget, you know, that we can often be quite, you know, with first cut silage area closed up, with a lot of demand early on in the year, a lot of farms might find themselves in a difficult position to take out paddocks for reseeding in the springtime. So look, you know, I wouldn't like to go too late in the year where you've shortened day length, you're going to get reduced light, reducing soil temperatures, you know, that will limit the uptake of clover. But one thing I would say with the clover is sometimes we've, you know, done both methods here, say for a red clover incorporation, being it autumn or spring, and we found the autumn, we probably were disappointed with the initial establishment, but come the following spring or maybe after first cut silage, we've had massive uptake and establishment of plants. So sometimes with clover, establishment may be slow and quite variable, but not necessarily a failure. That's just one thing that we have found, that, you know, that the seeds remained in the seed bed, and when they got the right conditions, maybe the following spring or early summer, you know, that they came through.
James, can I ask you, what do you do at home? Are you an autumn, are you a springtime reseed, or what have you? We don't need to hear just the good news stories. We can learn a lot as well from failures. But
there's bad news stories. luckily for me, most of my bad news stories have been when it's been trial work. So it's gone in a bit later and I've not had to cover all the cost of it. I completely agree with what Nicky's saying. Get them in early. The amount of, and it's obviously different in different areas of the UK. I mean, a few national grazing groups, and there's people put it in like quite legume herb dominant mixes late in the season, and it might work in the south of England. I'm obviously a bit more similar in climate to Nicky. It does not work in the north of England. Fine, we've had some tremendous takes in July into early August, but you've got to be lucky. If you hit a dry period sown at that time, you might not get rain for a month, then actually it's just germinating in September and it's too late really where we are. Certainly, yeah, as Nicky said, April till July is perfect for where we are.
And Nicky touched there on things like the pH and the soil indices of P and K. When you're going about your soil sampling, how important is the soil tests prior to establishment?
Less important than the reps historically led me to believe. And that was based off some of the trial work we've been doing. We're quite high K anyways on farm. Mm-hmm. We're pretty much between 2- and 3. P is very low. We're 0s and 1s. We've upped that really when we've got the rotation for the fodder beet for the winter grazing and so on. So that's followed by legumes and herbs. But the rest of the farm, the old permanent pasture, we're sitting at 0-1s. There's a lot of cost to try and get them up. And some of the initial work we did with ADAS, we started looking at the nutrient management required for these types of lays. The first year, we were like, oh, P is really important. So we had 4 different nitrogen treatments on 5 different mixes. Half of each of them blocks got P, half didn't. And it was a bit over maintenance P. And there was quite a big effect, but we hadn't randomized the site. It was basically half, the same half of all 5 trial plots under the 4 nitrogen regimes got P. So the next few years we randomized the site and it had absolutely no effect. So actually even applying well above maintenance on very low P soil, we didn't see a benefit there, which has kind of made me think, save a bit of dollar.
That's really interesting. Nikki, do you have any, would you have any comments back to that in the sense of looking at those P and K indices and what your research is showing?
Yeah, look, we're probably on a very different scale system. We have a 1-4 type mm-hmm. system here. We typically like to keep it up, you know, that 3, kind of that maintenance category. And like James said, if you run down into low indexes, it's very, very expensive to get right back up. So look, our big one, like our red clover silage system, is predominantly all cattle slurry. Mm-hmm. So we're recycling those nutrients. We're making, you know, good use, maybe targeting that finishing cattle slurry back to the paddocks that need it most. We're probably watching our offtakes. I think that's a really important one to kind of have a kind of a figure there for how much dry matter we're removing from the paddock so that at least we can target back and replace that offtake is probably, you know, really, really important. Look, one thing that we do, we probably nearly spread lime at the time of, we use, I suppose, a lot of min-till cultivation methods, be it disc harrow and so on with a one pass. We probably have a lot of, you know, decaying grass and herbage, you know, in the top few centimetres of that soil. So from those, we can get the production of a lot of organic acids that can be quite toxic to emerging seedlings. So what we, you know, we typically apply, you know, 1.5 to 2 tons of ground limestone per acre at the time of sowing to mm-hmm. neutralize some of that decaying plant material and the acids that will be produced from it, and as well as that maintain the pH of the soil. But mm-hmm. in terms of P and K, look, I'd say, like with James, you need to put on what you need. There's no point in going above or beyond that, you know. Mm-hmm. And then I think the big one though is to maintain them at those manageable levels, because if you slip down in the indexes, it's very, very expensive to build back up. But I think, look, we need to get better at making, you know, really good use of our organic manures, be it slurry or farmyard manure. You know, they're hugely valuable to our systems. And yeah, look, that's kind of our experience. Look, we try to maintain them at a good level mm-hmm. and try and make sure that they're never limiting that, you know, that they're, say, for research comparisons, we always have to keep the same level of fertility across treatments. So we keep them probably, you could say, at luxurious levels, that we know that it's not P and K that's limiting sward performance, that it's the varieties or it's the sward composition or something like that.
As Nikki said, that acidifying effect is really important. So we did a lot to start with. We always want the pHs to be good in our fields, but if we were spraying off thick, dense, old pasture, there was always a lot of mat on the top. So we'd use a very quick acting calcilime as opposed to a longer acting lime on there. Now, actually, we're focusing on that not being there for our direct drilling. So we'll use management to make sure we've not got that sort of old dense material on the sward anymore.
We've touched there on sort of preparing and sort of getting the foundations right for the seed. But the next question is, what do we need to take into consideration when we're picking that clover variety? So, Nikki, do you want to just take us through some of like how our objectives of the system and whether their suitability for grazing and cutting and how you're making those decisions on the seed variety?
Yeah, so I suppose just to begin with white clover, if we're selecting a variety, you know, obviously you have to know your system and know what you want from your sward. So I suppose in Ireland, on our recommended list, and I suppose the UK is the same, we have, you know, typically three categories for our white clover varieties, and they're based off leaf size. So typically, if we begin with our small leaf clover varieties, we probably, you know, these varieties, they have a smaller leaf. They won't seem as aggressive within the sward, but they still produce a relatively high level of stolon. So their nitrogen fixation capability is still quite good, but they'll probably work away quietly in the sward. And I suppose where they do probably have more of a role to play, and look, James will probably have more of experience of this, is probably in a sheep setting. So sheep clip with their lips, so they're capable of grazing much tighter than our cattle grazers. So by having a smaller leaf size, they can probably hide away, you know, within the sward and be protected from overgrazing from the sheep. Then if we move into, you know, our beef cattle grazing or intensive dairy cow grazing, our medium-leaved white clovers, you know, that's where they have a big role to play. So typically in Ireland, I suppose the main clover varieties that are used would be found in that medium-leaved category. And look, they have a good capability of, you know, supporting those kind of sward compositions that we need to get the animal and sward production benefits with the medium category. And I suppose we have the large leaf category. Personally, I think some of the large leaf categories were probably used in Ireland a number of years ago, and they probably gave clover a bad name in some regard, because they have a larger leaved, they're very aggressive in the sward. And what we probably found happening with those was they were taking over, you know, patches within the sward. And that was probably where some producers, you know, faced exposure to bloat occurrence with their herds, with those large patches of very aggressive large leaf clovers and getting clover takeover. So typically we see those large leaves, the use of those reserved for silage mixtures, where they might be put in to accompany a red clover variety within a silage production scenario. In terms of red clover in Ireland, I suppose we've no recommended list for red clover varieties. So we're totally reliant on the UK recommended list produced by yourselves. And one of the things that we really monitor in that is, you know, we're not really interested in kind of boom bust varieties that produce a lot of herbage in the first year and then that have a very, very rapid and steady decline between harvest years 2 and 3. So one thing that I always look for on the recommended list for red clover varieties is, you know, a high relative yield, especially in harvest year 3, and the maintenance of that ground score over years, if we look at the ground score category as well. I like to see varieties that are stable in terms of their plant populations, rather than ones that are really high but get a very rapid rate of decline over time. I think when we look at persistency and different things like that, we need to look at, you know, cumulative herbage production over a number of years, rather than just herbage production in one of those years.
James, how are you managing this at home? What are you kind of looking at when you're looking at different varieties to incorporate into the swards? Are you doing your own seed mixes, or are you buying sort of ready-made from the rep?
Predominantly mix all our own, whether that's winter forage or runoffs or like longer term lays. As just mentioned, yeah, it depends on the outcomes and what we want. So if we're wanting a long, productive, legume-based pasture, we'll want, yeah, a lot of medium-leafed clovers that have got good longevity. So we're looking at, yeah, persistency, production. They're very much in there. So we need to manage them to, yeah, have nodules, get that bacteria working, fix nitrogen. And as long as they're not stressed, that's going to be fine. In a drought, them nodules will knock off a bit. If the plant's stressed, it's not feeding the bacteria, but that bacteria is in the soil, it comes back. As soon as the rain comes, it will start working, it's fine. So the longer term aim of some of these mixes is certainly, yeah, persistency and performance. We do also target some quite short-term ones. There's two ways we sort of target them now. One that we've been doing for quite a few years is for the R2 cattle. So we'll wean the spring herd onto fodder beet for the winter, and then the autumn herd, their calves. So looking at sort of like 14, 16 months, we'll go on to the fodder beet as well. So we'll have that with deferred ground, but actually that's predominantly reseeded as we put the beet in. So we'll look at maybe getting a couple of cuts a year off that, and then leave it as a standing crop to graze alongside the fodder beet. So that we use red in there, but also burseem, or it's also called Egyptian, and we use crimson in there as well. That will go in there with Westerwolds and Italians. So that's something big bulk for just a year or two. And we'll generally double crop the fodder beet. So we're looking for 2 years, really booming there. The reds in there, because that'll perform better in the second year. The crimson, we're not getting as much even into that first year. The burseem does seem really good. That seems more of a biannual now. And actually, we've started to develop what we are grazing the ewe lambs. So we make all of our ewe lambs and we winter them. It used to be on a brassica mix. That mix has now developed a bit more. We wanted some green cover coming out of the winter. We didn't want as much bare soil and be as reliant on having to reseed as much in the winter. So we tried last year for a bit of green cover. So we're starting to put some burseem in there. We put some crimson, we put some grasses, we put some chicory. There's plantain in there now. And actually that has been phenomenal for what wasn't too good a yield in last year. That mix saved us in the drought. It established fairly well, and actually we weaned onto it and grazed it. We then grazed the ewe lambs on it after mating, and when the cattle came off the beet in March, we grazed it then. So it gave us last year 2.5 tons of dry matter in August, and then sort of turn of the year, December into January time. Didn't do that well in its first year, hard season for it. This season has been phenomenal. We got about 3 ton off it March into April with the cattle. We've done 2 cuts off it now, one at 4, one at 5 ton of dry matter. So actually in that scenario, it was going to be a yearly thing until we saw how well it was booming this year. And when we had an early drought, I was not taking that out of production, and I'm glad I'm not. That's probably the best mistake I've made, not spraying off that sword, because it is phenomenal this year. So yeah, we've got that sort of three-pronged approach with the legume, very long-term, putting them in a runoff alongside fodder beet for winter grazing for 2 years, or this year, green cover coming out of a winter grazing mix. And their manuals do well. I'm quite impressed with the burseem up here. It does, out of the burseem and crimson, seems to suit our system quite well.
And you've just touched on there, how long are you, when you're establishing or sort of reseeding, how long are you imagining these swards going into your rotation for?
It depends where on the farm it is. So we grow this sort of multi-grazing mix. We put in beet for the young cattle, and we're putting in fodder beet for wintering the ewes on as well. So in that rotation, there's about 6 years they're into, they're going with herbs and legumes, but they're into this multi-species clover dominant sort of sward for 6 years. And on the sheep rotation, on the cattle rotation, they're going in for 4 years. That last year in both scenario will be deferred for wintering cattle on. The permanent pasture on the farm, they're going in for as long as they last. We want these to be long term. Some of the species we're putting in won't be there forever. We're maybe chicories, plantains, they're going to be reducing the number sort of third, fourth year. Eventually, we're going to end up with a good grass clover lay plus a few other things in there. But no, these are viewed as long-term lays when we're putting them in quite often.
So when you're working with those, that permanent pasture, a big part of that is probably the overseeding and setting up that field for the best race of establishment. I feel like I just keep saying that word, which I probably do. But how deep are you going with those seeds, and how or what does that field look like when you're going into it to get the best success rate in there?
The best, we've trialed quite a few different methods over the years. One that's been the hardest is trying to do it with any cultivation, whether that's chemical or physical. So direct drilling into sort of an overseed without any spray or anything, very tricky. A lot more obvious when you've got broadleaf species in there, how successful it's been. In that scenario, it's very much winter sacrifice paddock, so we need to have quite a bit of trash on there through bale grazing or something of the likes that we then go in and stitch in. So that would be without a cultivation of any sorts or spray. A really successful way we found, and one that certainly works well going forward, and we will use a fair bit of, is using a bit of glyphosate. We do have to sort of use a spray on here, but instead of, Nikki mentioned earlier on, like that acidifying effect of the old matted sward. So if you go in early season, into the late season, you spray off an old pasture, it's quite a dense old sward. We used to do a bit of that. We'd put in the short term sort of line to try and counter it. But the plants are coming through a mat. It's a time of year we didn't really have sacrifice animals that we could try and hammer that off with. So actually what we're doing now, and I say it's working well for a number of reasons, is going into later cut silage. So maybe it's in early in the season, we identified who's getting reseeded. So we'll maybe graze it early season, shut it up in, end of May time, and rest it for 5, 6, 7 weeks for silage. And then we'd go in with a really low rate of Roundup over the top. So there's probably grass species we want in there. So they'll call it chemical topping in New Zealand. You basically, you're not touching the clovers with that rate of Roundup. So you're promoting what clover's there, but you are giving a fairly decent knock to that grass for a few months. So we've trialled between a quarter and a half rate. Both of them will kill for the majority of the season. And then we'll cut a few days later. And if you ever see a silage layer when you've cut it, it's quite open at the bottom. And that's, say, the issue of that dense, matted, permanent pasture is gone once you've rested it for a period for silage. So as soon as you've cut it and taken it off, you've already knocked back the grass that's there for a few months with the spray. You've got that open sward that you want for the new seedlings coming through. And then we'll direct drill straight into that. We'll also, if we're doing that sort of in July time, we've weaned sheep there, so we've got a low priority stock class on farm that we can then go and hammer that sward down further. And like, you can cut it quite low if you're not looking at the regrowth on it, but there's still a bit there. There's bits that have been missed by the pickup on the baler or something. There's field edges that you've got, corners you've not cut. So use them sheep to really hammer it down. And then when they walk out after a week or so of being on there, it almost just looks like a cultivated field. So you've got so much open space for the new seedlings coming through and getting going. And as an establishment method, it's pretty much the best one we found.
Nikki, what are you seeing at Chagas or even on your home farm when you're bringing in for the beef cattle grazing systems? Is it in after silage you're finding the best results, or... Again, what does that feel looking like, or how are you preparing it for something like overseeding?
Yeah, in terms of overseeding, it kind of exactly what James described there. What we try to do with overseeding, irrespective of method or anything, is to outcompete that grass. Mm-hmm. So really, by going in after that silage cut, you have a relatively bare, a clean type seed bed where you maximize the chance of getting, you know, good soil seed contact. And as well as that, you know, your grass is somewhat stunted, so it's not going to be back grown as rapidly as it normally would, and it'll allow, you know, light down to that seedling for as long as possible. But like that, you need to maintain a relatively low cover to allow the light back into that. So, you know, with your beef cattle, that's going to be coming back in, you know, at a very, very early interval. To get that. And Peter Doyle here in Chagas Grange would have done a massive body of work in oversowing white clover into a suckler beef system with really, really good success. But it's probably the most important thing is the post-sowing management, you know, that to keep with it, to avoid, you know, building up heavy covers that are going to starve the new clover for light, as well as that, maybe avoid damage to the new and emerging clover plant as well. So look, you'd be going in with a roll after getting your seeds in, but trying to, you know, minimize the amount of physical damage that you might have on that for a while the seedling is emerging and a shoot is developing.
So we've touched a lot on the varieties in the seed, but we haven't mentioned seeding rate of clover. Is this something that you've trialed different rates? James, I'll come to you first. Is this something that you've have you done differently compared?
Quite a lot, and as they we're a bit more than just clover going in. So there's been various mixes trialled over the years. We see that clover very like a very important part. That's driving the performance of that lay to start with, when there's other things in there as well as the grasses and the legumes. But even later on, we want a high clover content. So it depends what's in the sward already. If we're, say, sprayed off quite a high clover content sward with Roundup known, we're promoting that clover, we're not going quite as high. If we're going in, say, after the beet or something, a full reseed, we'll go in higher. We'll go in at sort of 1.8 kilos to the acre of white, plus a couple of kilos of burseem there for the initial cut that we'll take off it to clean up the annuals. So fairly high. But yeah, most pastures we're going in at least 1.5 up to sort of 1.8. Because yeah, I don't think you can get too much clover, to be honest.
We've already highlighted at the start of this section some of the challenges our farmers face around weed management. James, do you want to talk us through some of, well, let's start with post-emergence now. How are you managing those weeds and sort of maximising the clover and grass emergence?
So it depends on the method. We mainly go direct. If it's in a permanent pasture, it's never planted. It's always direct drilled. So actually, we're not too bad on annuals coming away. We have a bit of an issue if they're going in a drought with thistles coming away. If you've got a fairly bare field and a drought for a few months, thistles seem to thrive, which is a little bit annoying. Not much we can do post-emergence, but the following year we can go in with a weed wiper. We'll just, any of these lays we've got, we can't touch with a single spray here. So we'll graze down and we'll go in with we've got a 6 metre weed wiper, so you can quite quickly get across paddocks after grazing. We're all fairly small paddocks here, so if you're just popping out for 20 minutes to cover a paddock after some stocks come out, it's quite an easy thing. Generally, if we've taken them out the following year, they're pretty clean going forward. Where we do have more of an issue is if we're following the rotation of the winter grazing. So especially the fodder beet, the sprays are pretty useless now on fodder beet, which I know a few people did organically. It wasn't the weeds in the fodder beet crop, it was the following year trying to reseed, and that is a nightmare even in a conventional system. So as I mentioned, if we go into a bare field, we'll go a high rate of the clover, we'll put that burseem in there as well, and we'll put in some oats, so we're taking that as an early cut of arable silage. A lot of people use peas and beans, not really needed in our system here. We're getting that extra protein from the burseem, we'll get some initial sort of yield after the cut, then for a sort of year or so it's going to be contributing until that clover gets going. Clover is quite slow to get going here. I know some people will be phenomenal the first year. We've seen like maybe that second, third year the clover really booming, so that sort of shorter term clover there helps. But now we're fat hen, chickweed, red shank, they're all a right pain. Their annuals will smother and kill out anything coming through. So the fact that we're putting in with the oats and the burseem with the idea is this gets cut. It gets cut early and it gets cut. Mm-hmm. And we'll take them out. And to more like suckler cows, you can feed them anything. Absolutely fine winter feed for them. That spring herd, they can live off that all right in the winter outside.
And Nikki, do you want to just follow on from that? We've already highlighted maybe the difference in Ireland having that derogation to use the likes of products like Clover Max and that. But again, what would your advice be, or your top tips when managing weeds post-emergence?
Yeah, so I suppose there's probably one of the big ones that we had a challenge with would have been chickweed. So we've no product that is clover safe and that can be used to combat against chickweed. And particularly, you know, chickweed probably is more of a problem in those late sown reseeds, so those autumn reseeds. And so what we would have done in the past, where we, you know, you will see the chickweed will grow at lower soil temperatures and it will grow into the winter months. And what it can do, you know, it'll choke out, you know, patches within the sward. It's very aggressive and, you know, it's something we really do need to remove. So, like, you know, it's defoliation is what we need. You know, once it is cut out of the sward, it'll generally go away. So what we do, we will graze all reseeds, you know, quite a tight grazing for that first defoliation. And what we have done, where we had a lot of challenge, you know, over the winter from chickweed, is a very, very tight grazing with animals early on in the spring, and pulling a grass harrow across the sward afterwards to remove and any of that chickweed that remained in the sward. And we've done that with great success and a really, really clean red clover dominant pastures. So look, we're very fortunate with the availability of those clover safe sprays still, that we can get control of those broadleaved weeds. And really, you know, they are an important role, some of these sprays, when used wisely, you know, for low nitrogen systems, they are an important tool to promote that.
One of the questions that we're getting asked a lot is from farmers is management. Come springtime, they've established their reseed and they're now gone into a drought period, a prolonged dry period, where the clover has not germinated or established itself well enough to outcompete these weeds. What do they do in those cases? What's the best way forward for them? James, when you're seeing there come May this year, June, July, how are you keeping those weeds at bay?
So that would be in a reseed. So you're looking at a prior year reseed and then the issues going forward. Right, so we put in 9 new trial plots last year for ADAS. We mentioned earlier the sowing date, and I was glad Nikki said go early, because that's certainly what we find. But we sort of tried to establish on the cusp of what we'd sort of get away with here. So we looked at end of June, mid-July, beginning of August, sort of mid-late August. What we essentially ended up doing is just repeatedly try to establish new pasture in the middle of a drought. So that was quite a challenging time. We got very little rain for about 3 months, 3.5 months here. So the knock-on effect was poorer covers that first year. Normally, if we're putting in a reseed, that's or even July period after a silage, we'll get 2 good grazings. And we were talking off like a foot, 10 inches, 10 to 14 inches of material twice that first season. So we're getting a good graze. We didn't touch 80% of their reseeds last year. There was only a couple of paddocks that got grazed. So coming into this year, it was that exact scenario. We had poorer cover than we'd wanted from a reseed, and the thistles did do fairly well. Interestingly, chickweed did phenomenally as well this year. And I think there'll be the same reason for both. An early drought and a decent taproot, then plants didn't get affected. So there was space there in the sward, and that was a year for them, 2 things to thrive. The year before, with the drought, actually, I think Birdsfoot Trefoil has done tremendously well for us. I think clover potentially could have as well, through a bit of seed set. If you had a lot of clover seed there in the sward, so certainly we had the Birdsfoot Trefoil seed, I think that's established quite well in a drought. So the following year, we're seeing a lot higher numbers. But as for the weed set, say thistles was the one that got us this year on the V seeds in the spring. And yeah, for us, it was the weed wiper going in and taking them out. I mean, obviously, you can top, you can dig them, whatever you want to do for removing the thistles. Again, we just graze down and wipe them. It seems to work the best for us.
Nikki, do you have anything to add on that? Because this is obviously something that, well, it knocks a lot of confidence in farmers. They've made an investment into reseeding. They're not getting the results that they see that they want. Is their go-to afterwards a high sugar tetraploid grass instead of a clover? The thing I'm hearing from both of you is it's patience when working with clover is a big thing. For those farmers, Nikki, who have had that knockback on establishing, what do you think is their next step and trying again, I suppose?
I wouldn't panic, and sometimes I think farmers can panic a little bit too much. You know, you're probably better off if it doesn't germinate, and comes into a drought, you're probably better off if the seeds maybe remain ungerminated in the seed bed, and that they're ready for when the moisture does come. The worst thing is if we do get germination, that the, you know, we get sprouting of the seed. The seed is the energy reserve, the carbohydrate energy reserve to fuel the growth of that plant. And until that plant has, you know, a root or a shoot put down, you know, it won't be able to get much from the soil. So really, we're probably better off maybe sometimes if it doesn't germinate. Sometimes you see farmers watering a pasture to kind of get establishment going during a drought, but the amount of water that you have to give, you know, is a massive, massive quantity, and you could do more harm than good. But one of the rules of thumb that we probably have here, or certain farm advisors would have, is if you have a grass plant, you know, under your heel and under your toe, that probably is okay. That sward will have the ability to tiller and thicken out over time. Like what James said earlier, we had a very prolonged drought last summer, and our red clover swards actually did very, very well. And that is because, you know, they developed that tap root. They probably developed it, you know, nearly just prior to the drought fully setting in, and they were able to actually do quite well during that. Look, your tetraploid seeds as well probably do have a little bit more vigor. They might be a thinner sward. They probably are more vigorous and more rapid to get going, and probably can develop a root system somewhat quicker than your diploid. So there is small things, but maybe sometimes not to panic. I know some of your big aggressive leads, like your big thistles and different things, will seem to thrive and get going irrespective of the weather conditions. But I think, you know, your grass seed is very resilient, and your clover seeds probably can remain there and probably will come hopefully at some stage. But look, yeah, it's avoiding. We're probably seeing trends of when some of these droughts do emerge in particular regions. So it's trying to work around that and come up with a reseeding plan that suits your farm and the demand profile of your herd as well.
James, do you want to add to that?
Yeah, certainly to echo what Nikki just said. So the 9 trial plots we put in last year during the drought, it was their middle ones that struggled the most. So the early one was fine. There was enough moisture in the soil that got going. It was fine during the drought. It came away. The next sort of sowing date was the one that struggled because there was just enough to get the seedling going. Mm. So they germinated, but then there was nothing for a couple of months for them. So they did a bit poorly in places. And the only ones we had to stitch in the spring here in a few patches were from them sowing dates. The subsequent sowing dates, we stuck them in the ground. There was no moisture, nothing came away, and it was fine. They just came away with the rain. The botanical assessments we had, actually, them later ones, there was a lot more of the prior grass in them because they were sprayed off and direct drilled, just with having that longer period. And actually, I think glyphosate works a little poorer in stressful conditions, either very dry or very wet. So that old sward came back more. So the botanical sort of composition wasn't as good really in them, but the seed did survive and do fine. When it went in early and there was a moisture just to get it going, it struggled. And it was a trial we had to put in the ground. The best thing in that scenario is keep it in the bag. We've not touched on the most important thing on any reseed. The most vital thing we always find is decent rain. And you can't predict it. We don't have a magic ball, unfortunately, or if someone does, they need to share it to farmers. But yeah, if you can get this in the ground and get good rainfall pretty soon afterwards, you're just flying then.
Nikki, is that a problem in Ireland? I'm not sure.
Definitely not this year. No, we've too much rain for sure.
So we've touched on how important the management is afterwards, coming into spring after you've done your reseed. And I heard recently, and this, I didn't make this figure up, but apparently only 5% of clover swards in the UK are managed correctly. And the key to success and persistency in the sward, it is down to management. And I think that's something that you've highlighted already, and making those decisions in a timely manner. Nikki, how does the management differ between clover swards and just straight perennial rice swards? Even just starting with the management of the reseed come early spring, How are we managing that differently as to just a straight grass perennial biosupport?
Yeah, so I suppose one of the big things where farmers may fall down in terms of encouraging a lot of clover into the sport is probably the spray. So the spray management, you know, that big worry about controlling those broadleaves, you know, farmers might go in with a non-clover safe product and eliminate the clover straight away out of the sport. Or even where using a clover safe product, they may well go in too early, but you know, where the clover plant isn't probably ready for the spray, or maybe, you know, going in, allowing a very heavy cover build up on those clover swards and starving it from light. So I think a combination of factors, you know, can reduce the level of clover in our swards. If we look at Ireland, you know, I think somewhere in the region, of an industry figure might be that 80% of clover swards historically, or of grass seed sales, contain clover. But if we look at our swards on farm and look at what contains significant amounts of clover, you know, it is quite low. And really, one of the big problems with it was that historically, you know, chemical nitrogen was quite cheap. So farmers and probably your better grassland managers were putting out, you know, very high levels of chemical nitrogen and reducing the role of the clover, so it became redundant within the sward and burnt out. Maybe in some of the dry stock scenarios, why we might have low clover is, you know, excessively high pre-graze and herbage masses, and perhaps a set stocking type system then assigned to those where we have long residency times and maybe overgrazing of the swards as well. And as well as that, across all systems, probably poor soil fertility in a lot of cases can reduce, you know, the role of clover within those swards. So that's just, you know, I think it's a combination of factors where swards were probably mismanaged somewhat to encourage high levels of clover. But I think in the last year or two, on the back of increasing fertilizer and feed cost, we've seen, you know, a massive focus on clover, be it red or white. And I think the necessary management to go in on the back of those, I think, has really, really improved. And look, we see all the research studies, you know, show the positives in terms of sward productivity from lower levels of chemical nitrogen, as well as associated improvements in animal performance. You know, so look, I think we can't avoid the benefits of clover. It does require a change to our management, but it's well worth it.
Part of that management is how soon can we get in there grazing and cutting those clover swards? And are there any guidelines to the management or the decision making around, I suppose, we'll start with grazing first and then move on to the silage side of it.
Yeah, so I suppose if we just take some of our recommendations for a newly established sward, we probably try to avoid taking a silage harvest from it in the first year. And the reason being that, you know, we probably allow it build up to a high herbage mass in order to cut the silage, and we may starve it from light, and allowing it, you know, go up to that high herbage mass as well, we probably reduce the tillering capacity. So really what we are trying to do is get, you know, about week 5 to 6 after sowing, you know, and provided we get optimum growth, we probably would be trying to get in, you know, get our post-emergent spray on. And then, you know, a week to 10 days following that, we're probably trying to get in and get those swards grazed off with a light first grazing to encourage tillering and of that sward. And probably avoiding, you know, in the case of a white clover sward, avoiding taking a silage off it for the first year. That would be our own managements that we do put in place. And look, that'll change different, you know, James has talked about, you know, the use of, you know, arable silages or different mixes, you know, that help combat the challenge from weeds. So kind of a companion forages there to outcompete some of those broadleaf weeds that might get going, you know, in the absence of those sprays. You know, I think that's hugely important and something that we're probably going to have to look to doing again here in Ireland. We probably, you know, have the easy option where we do have the clover safe spray, that we can use that as a tool in our management, but that may not always be there, so we need to look at alternatives as well as that.
James, do you have anything you want to add to that in the sense of how you're managing those reseeds?
Well, other than what we've touched on, really, I suppose if you know there's going to be a high burden, so I suppose the beet and our scenario, I mentioned the organic farmers that I knew that grew tremendous organic beet, but the next year was knackered because fat-headed red shank had just been setting seed all year. So in that scenario, if you know you're going to have a high weed burden, it means take the land out of production for a little bit longer, but start looking at stale seed beds. Certainly, we had one field this year. It's the first time we'd done it. We are conventional, so we can use spray. But we knew coming out of a field of cattle beet for a couple of years, there'd been a lot of fat end, particularly in there. We leveled that field, rolled it, and then left it for, I think it was 3.5-4 weeks until we saw everything come. It looked like a great reseed for the neighbours. All this all was green. I thought, oh, you did a good job. We hadn't sowed a single thing in that field. So we sprayed it off and direct drilled it, and it's been a really clean reseed. Obviously, if you're organic, you could go back over with whatever cultivation technique you use or even just a combi drill. But yeah, if you're predicting high seed burden of weeds, I suppose you can think you're going to have to do something about it. But yeah, we can, a bit of spray, pre-direct drill and nothing once it's in the ground for us.
My next question is back to Nikki, because while I was at the Moor Park Open Day, I saw a farmer, or was able to overhear a farmer challenging Nikki on this topic, and it was on soil or clover maturity and when to graze it and when to leave it for cutting, and basically around the management of it. Now, that farmer was saying he would not be putting calves into that red clover sward, but Nikki, it was really interesting to hear how the timing of clover maturity and how to time it correctly to maximize the nutritional value of it. What are the guidelines around that? Are you waiting for flowering, or are you waiting, are you going to go a little bit earlier? Because I suppose there is a trade-off there, especially with the red clover, between the lignified areas of the stem, but also getting to the right stage of yield.
What you're getting at there is, I suppose, we do graze our red clover swards with light dairy beef calves, you know, at that light cover for the first grazing. And we've done that, you know, without any issues here in Grange. And we might do that once or twice, you know, over the early summer. And then we might let it go on and enter into our kind of conventional type silage system thereafter. But I think where you're on about the maturity stage, that's probably relating back to our decision to cut the crop. So really what we typically try to do is ensure that between our silage harvest that we leave about 6 to 7 weeks. And the reason that we've really focused on maintaining this interval between cutting dates is to ensure if you look at a red clover field, you get this really, really rapid regrowth after cutting it. And if we take it that regrowth is exclusively been fueled by the carbohydrate reserve that is in the deep taproot of that plant, and it uses all of that energy to, you know, establish a very rapid canopy on the crop. And you know, it's really noticeable. Everyone with red clover will say the regrowth is huge, but it's using that its own plant reserve to fuel that. And really why we want to leave a long enough interval is to allow it establish a canopy that it can intercept maximum sunlight and allow enough time to benefit from that canopy to replenish that carbohydrate reserve through the photosynthesis process. So really 6 to 7 weeks. And typically, you know, for our second cuts, you'll see that little red bud just starting to emerge on the crop. You know, when we've about 20 to 30% of the paddock with that red bud just emerging, it's not going to seed or anything like that, that we probably get a good balance between allowing enough time between harvest dates and, you know, ensuring that we maintain a sward nutritive value as well. So that's just one of the little management tools that we've ensured. And look, if we look at our clover swards now with harvest year four, they look as good as ever. You know, they're kind of, at the moment, they're going to be mid 70s to mid 80s in terms of their red clover proportion. at you know, 3 to 4 years of age. So we're really happy with that type of maintenance. And that's just one of the things that we're watching, is that we're not being too greedy with the plant, that we're not cutting at very, very short intervals. We may think we have enough forage there, but we allow, you know, we maintain that 6 to 7 week kind of a cutting interval to allow it fully replenish the plant reserves and to increase the persistence of that sward over, you know, as many years as possible.
And one of the other things, Nicky, is, I suppose, it's the cutting height. And you've mentioned grazing. I suppose it will come into it as well, that grazing height and managing and protecting the crown of the plant. What are the guidelines around that?
Yeah, so one thing that we've probably struggled a little bit on this, because, look, we have been measuring stubble heights of post-mowing. And look, they probably, you know, they're not compressed heights. We measure them with a graduated ruler. So it's the standing height of the stubble. And they typically are your you know, 6-7 centimetres after your conventional mowers. Because we have a comparison between grass only and grass clover, we keep a common cutting height between the two of them. But really, I wouldn't be overly concerned about the cutting height. You know, I think a moderate cutting height on both your grass only and your grass clover. But I think that the stage at what we cut the standing crop at is probably more important. So kind of not letting it go beyond that 6-7 week interval and going into excessively heavy crops where the growing point has traveled up the shoot of the plant. You know, if we let it bulk up an awful lot and we cut at the same cutting height, we're actually demanding a lot more from that plant than if we cut it at a lighter cover when the growing point sits a little lower in the sward. So, you know, I think your cutting height is probably very relative to what you start with or what you go in and cut. I don't know what James's experience might be on that, or adjusting more heights. We've toyed with it and we probably need a standalone trial to maybe look at that. But it can be quite difficult to do.
Yeah, cut as high as you can really to promote regrowth. You can do a lot of damage. Cutting it too low, you don't do much damage. Cutting it too high, do you?
Is this something that when you're going into a field, when you're managing that grazing, those grazing swards compared to your cutting swards, it's something that you're conscious of, that you would treat them differently?
Depends on the context, I suppose, what the requirements are, what the stock class is for it. If we're looking at something that's going to be booming finishing pasture for young lambs, we're very much wanting to manage that to be at the peak stage of quality. I went and baled some the other day for bale grazing. So we've cut it, we've laid the bales out in the field, and that's going to be grazed, well, between December and March with the autumn herd with calves at foot. We want quality there. It wants to be all right, but I mean, it's a suckler cow. It doesn't need much. So we're looking at standing hay essentially with some decent clover levels in it. It depends on the context and what stock class you've got in there. If you're going into high covers with priority stock, look at your grazing system. You can do it. It's fine. We do a bit of leader follower. Works really well in that scenario. It's these mixed species and you're hitting... May, June into July, them things can be booming. If you've got rye grasses there, like, unless you're going to have a 10, 12 day rest period in some scenarios, you're not going to keep on top of them seed heads. If you're looking at a grazing system, you're going to have to look at a way to prioritize. At that time, we were generally lactating ewes and then under weaned lambs, but you're going to have to look at a way that priority stock is getting the nutritional requirement they need without affecting day live weight gain. So, whack some lambs in there or some lactating ewes and follow up a cattle behind to clean it up. They're going to take the best pick to start with. There's a higher ME diet than that priority livestock going in front, and you're cleaning up with something that doesn't need as good a good feed quality. But yeah, so if you are going high, just be careful if you're not cutting. The other thing is, like, graze it and then, yeah, rest a few weeks and cut it to tidy up. There's quite a few options. Depends on the season. It can be a huge difference between one year and the other. For us, making sure we can keep things grazing's the most important thing. Silage, we can be a bit flexible when we make that.
One of the things that we've touched on a few times, or it's been mentioned a few times now, is persistency. And this is something that our farmers, again, it highlighting the need of how do I manage this crop to ensure persistency throughout the first year, the second year, and the years to come. What are the kind of guidelines behind this? Nikki, we'll go to you first. What are the decisions through that, we'll start with a grazing season, that will help to support and prolong the persistency of the crop?
Yeah, so I suppose if we look at our white clovers, definitely I think the big one is your pre-graze and harvest mass. So like what James said, not going into excessively high covers, you know, you're going to penalize your animal, you're going to let it get a deterioration of sward quality. You know, from grazing very heavy covers as well, you may get a very slow regrowth as well. But the big one is you're going to starve the legumes and the clover in there of light, and you're going to, you know, reduce its percentage within the sward. The soil fertility, I think, is going to be a massive one. Soil P and K, pH, they're going to be big drivers of whether that clover will remain in that grazing sward. Grazing management, like I think, look, with your cattle grazing, you know, we probably do, and you probably will get tight grazings where you have a lot of clover. It's easier. There's kind of a lower shear strength of the sward that animals can, you know, if we look at cattle that graze with their tongue, they can wrap that around a clover sward and shear it from the sward with a lot less effort than in a really, really dense grass sward. So they will work down to naturally lower residual heights where there is a lot of clover in the sward. But that is probably important as well, you know, that we maximize the light that hits the base of that clover plant. But one thing with grazing heights, what we want to be, we don't want to penalize the animal. And if you're forcing animals to graze down because you start off with the wrong pre-grazing herbage mass, you know, you're going to restrict the dry matter intake of that animal. And that's something that we do not want to do. So we need to work with our animals in terms of what we offer them. And, you know, we need to offer the appropriate pre-grazing herbage mass, which will minimize the effort that animal has to put in to get it down to the targeted graze out. So look, clovers can help that. They can make it easier for the sward to be removed.
James, is this something that you've experienced on farm or in some of your swards, that persistency dropping off? And how are you addressing it?
Not in white clover, really. Obviously, we're putting in crimson, berseem, red. That is short term. We expect it to be short term. The annuals, mm-hmm. some of them biannuals, red's obviously a bit longer. White, nah, persistency. White clover can be absolutely tremendous in 30, 40, 50-year-old fields that have never been reseeded. Can be absolutely tremendous for white clover under the right situation. So I imagine grazing management has got more to play than anything else on that. I know a few people, when they first started getting into all-grass wintering systems, so nice rest periods, short, sharp grazings, and that was one of the first things they saw was improvement in clover and these really old lays. So I think the management of the swards is quite important for clover. And yeah, like clover, last white clover lasts anyways. And that's the thing that drives grazing for us, really. I mean, the herbal mixes we do, there's persistency issues with a few of them. Any reseed we put in now goes in with a whole host of things, heaps of legumes, heaps of herbs. Say some of them we expect to be there 3 or 4 years, really booming and starting to die out. Essentially, what we all see these being left with is a high clover content grass lay, whether that's 6 years, whether it's 10 years, whatever we can get out of it is a benefit. But no, that white clover, we pretty much be a given that that's going to be there, unless, I mean, even all grass wintering, like we could hammer things with cattle and the clover still coming back fine. We've probably opened more soil up and given it more light to help it, but I know. I imagine if you lashed on a load of nitrogen, you maybe is going to be a bit more detrimental to it, but certainly, a low to no nitrogen system, we've not really seen much issues with persistency in white clover here.
Great to know you're in that top 5%, James, of well-managed clover swards in the UK. I've no doubt you are. We've come to the end of the sections now that we've kind of covered off establishment, the management side of it. We've touched on the nutrient side and the nutrient management. But one of the things that we really just wanted this podcast to answer the questions for our farmers. So we put out a bit of a request across our discussion groups and they've submitted some of their questions. We'll have touched on a lot of them already. So I'm just going to have a look through and see maybe what we haven't touched on yet. So it's open to both of you. The first one is, can inspecting the nodules of the clover tell us more about how active the nodules are? So yes. What do the colours indicate? James, did you want to start to attempt to answer this one?
Well, I'll get there before the expert because it would be wrong. But yeah, so if it's young and whitey-grey colour, maybe you get a bit of age on them. And yeah, you're looking at a ready, sort of pinky ready nodule on. I think sort of mentioned earlier, actually, you might be in a 4 or 5 year lay that you've seen nodules there before and you dig them up and think, oh, they've gone. But if it's a stressed plant, it's putting energy into conserving number one. When it's in a stress-free environment, there's sun, there's moisture, it's going to put some energy into the bacteria and then nodules to start fixing the nitrogen. So yeah, in a stressed environment, in a drought or something, then nodules might go, but the bacteria's there. You've not wrecked the biology of your soil or anything, and the drought hasn't or whatever's caused the stress. And yeah, once things go back to normal, you should have the nodules back and them doing what you want them to be doing.
Nikki, is this something you assess when you're looking at your clover trials?
Yeah, we'd probably. So I suppose most of my work is probably mostly on red clover. So you probably do get, you know, more rapid development of nodules on that red clover plant because it is a bigger seed size. It's probably a little bit more aggressive to get going. And we probably do see nodules emerge on that quite early on. But I suppose if we look at those nodules, as James said, you know, an indicator of that the nodules, you know, are fixing nitrogen is that if we dissected one of them, just cut the little nodule open, you might see that it's pink or reddish. That's in, you know, so we might see nodules that are just white or gray and, you know, they're there, they're developed, but we know that, you know, maybe that they're not supporting, you know, the bacteria there to fix that atmospheric and nitrogen and make a plant ready available. So, you know, at an early stage, you will have nodules, but whether or not they're fixing nitrogen, you know, we need to determine by looking at the color of those. But typically, you know, there probably is indications in your red clover plant that from, you know, month 3, that they are capable of starting to develop, are capable, you know, from month 3 to 6, that they probably can fix some level of nitrogen. But I suppose they will use this nitrogen to sustain their own growth as well. And not all of the nitrogen fixed is going to be available to the grass or other plants growing in the sward. So, you know, we need to be careful about how much nitrogen we estimate those new emerging swards to be fixing. And look, after cultivation, you are going to get mineralization of nitrogen in the soil. So you're going to get, you know, a certain bit of a kick from that soil disturbance, mineralization of nitrogen that will benefit all the plants in the sward. And after that probably begins to dwindle, you know, your legumes will be kicking into play as well and fixing some of their own. You're probably talking a later response from your white clover, you know, that you're probably not going to be fixing any significant amounts, you know, probably within that first year, you know, and it's probably thereafter that you will. But you will see with red clover, it's often used as a catch crop in tillage scenarios because it is probably capable fixing some a little bit earlier on, but it's probably not until we get, you know, senescence of that red clover plant that we get a release of this nitrogen as well, that it's from decaying plant material adding to organic matter in the soils that we can get, you know, big uptake of nitrogen from the red clover especially. And that's why we see in our swards here, that is probably not until September onwards when we get that clover melt that we see, you know, that the grass really becomes really, really lush in the sward. So it's on the back of that decaying plant material that we get a massive release of nitrogen.
James, I see, do you want to add something in there? You're on the edge of your seat.
Nicky covered it at the end. Really, when we put in a new sward, we wouldn't really count on much coming from that clover in the first year, especially when it's multi-species with various legumes and whiting. That's year two before we're thinking we're getting much fixation there. Actually, some of the trial plots we did initially, we saw early season in a good season. So if it's sort of warm early season, actually that fixation's there and was matching a 40 kilogram per hectare of nitrogen application. In a bad season, that's when we saw the benefit of that early application. Actually, most of the subsequent applications in that trial, there were only 30 kilograms of N to a hectare per application. They were just matching what the clover was doing in the sward. And that was even in the second year of a white clover base lay. But we saw the benefit early season in a poor year.
One of the next questions we got, and I think we touched on this earlier, was how do you establish clover in a sward when weed burden includes fat hen and deadly nightshade? This reseed is present on sandy hills and used for outwintering.
Bloody hate fat hen. It is doing phenomenally this year around this part of the world for some reason. I have no idea why. And I say the herbicides are useless against it. Once it's there, it's a bit tricky, I suppose, isn't it? It depends what you've got. Again, I'll keep mentioning a weed wiper, like it's 6 meters, we can fly across a cropper, right? The multi-graze mix that we put in, so we whacked in another 4.5 hectares quite early in the season. Obviously, drought conditions in May, phenomenal for the fat hen, was going to smother anything underneath it. So actually, instead of topping it, because there was going to be too much, we went in with the mower and just baled the fat head off it to chuck it to one side. So way before it was going to set seed and cause any harm, but it was going to just hammer any sort of seedlings coming underneath it. So yeah, we actually baled and removed a fairly decent crop of fat hen this year, which is no use for bloody anything. But there was a benefit in getting it off the field, certainly. Deadly nightshade was it, don't really have to deal with here, so not much experience.
One of the next questions is, what's the best way to maximise persistency in clover within a grass lay? Now, I know I've already asked this question, but he has found that the clover, despite doing well in the reseed initially, has started to disappear from the lays after a few years. Nicky, do you want to maybe touch on this on why he might be seeing that drop back?
Yeah, and look, it could be a case, is it soil fertility? Mm-hmm. And, you know, in those initial years, you know, you're probably after giving luxury amounts of P and K, you know, at the start, at the time of sowing, are they still benefiting on the back of that? Or is it a case that, you know, that farmer hasn't maybe relied on the clover and is reducing reduced nitrogen application, and that the clover plant is becoming lazy now, you know, that it has been in there a number of years, but you're still spreading conventional amounts of chemical fertilizer. So the role of the clover, you know, will be reduced where we're not relying on it to fix the nitrogen. So that, you know, we know from red clover that, you know, nitrogen application will reduce the clover percentage and will reduce the amount of nitrogen fixed. So, you know, it could be a case that it, you know, it's a high chemical nitrogen level and that the role of clover has been reduced under that type of management.
I think that nitrogen, they say, is going to make it lazy and less of a requirement for that clover in the sward. Maybe that has a bit of a knock-on effect. Grazing management, good rest periods, graze it down, give it some light, give it a rest so it grows back again. We're not really seeing too many issues, to be honest, with the persistency of it, but not whacking nitrogen on these fields or anything. I do see more of a persistency issue with some of the other species we put in, and certainly some of the initial work we started doing with what grass species were sown against the herbal lays really had a big effect on the persistency. It just randomly came off a stupid idea we had with a seed company about a multi-cutting mix they had over in Holland, I think it was. So whereas traditionally we were putting a lot of diploids in, it was a grazing mix. People said diploids are good for grazing. We whacked them in with the herb legumes, but obviously they tiller and they smother everything out. So we put in this multi-cut system. There's a lot more tetraploids. I think there's some hybrid ryegrass in there, things that were going to grow up and not outwards. And actually, the persistency was so much better in them. So the grass species we're sowing now, we're actually putting a load of hybrid ryegrasses in. So I say we expect a few things to die out in a few years, potentially. So if we're putting hybrid ryegrass in there to start with, we're getting really good early season yield for our first graze. And actually, that's something that's booming for a few years and it's growing up. It's not a diploid, it's not a tillering and smothering other species out. Quite often, these mixes have got fairly poor grasses in. We want the grass there to be good and something we want, because like, we're looking at this long term. It's not just in for a few years. We put Timothy in there, Festaloniums. We will put a low rate of diploid, but we're talking fairly low. So actually that maybe is really starting to take over in year four or five or something when them other species are going. So potentially what's getting sown there with the clover as well could have a bit of an issue. But I'd imagine, yeah, management and nitrogen use are probably higher up the list.
If you have time for two more questions left. So thank you for sticking with us. One of the next ones are, I'll put it over to Nikki. What's the best way of managing clover coming into that closing period for the best results next spring?
So on our clover systems that we have, one of the things we do is try and carry a low cover into the winter months on those clover swards. And we want to do that, you know, to maximize the light that's getting down to the clover plant to encourage, you know, stolon development over the winter and over winter growth of the clover. And we want to reduce the competition from the grass plant for that really important light, you know, when growth does start to kick off in the springtime. And I suppose the limitations of that is, if we look at our typical grass-based system, probably 60% of the herbage available in the springtime is grown over the autumn months. So in a, you know, a clover rich system where we're trying to carry forward, you know, a low cover over the winter, we probably do limit ourselves in terms of herbage availability in early spring. So that can be one of the downsides, you know, to that really rich clover type system. And then sometimes where we have paddocks that have, you know, been taken over to a large extent by white clover, you know, we probably do carry a heavier cover on some of them just to thin out the clover a little bit and bring it back to a more manageable sward content in terms of a grazing system.
James, last question over to you. It sounds like you grow clover for fun, so this might suit you. How are you managing high clover content in grazing swards, and are your livestock at risk of bloat?
Yeah, they are at risk of bloat. And that's kind of how we developed what we actually graze on farm. So we post-mortem anything that dies on farm. So when we first started playing with sort of red clovers, plantains, a bit of lucerne and a lot of white in the mixes, suddenly it was about the same period we started post-mortem and everything. So we're seeing a lot of intestinal torsion, so red gut. And I don't know, to start with, you kind of expect a few dead animals and you kind of put it down, oh, it's a sheep, it dies. But actually having everything post-mortem by a professional could tell us it was kept being intestinal torsions. So we kept looking at actually how can we improve this. There's obviously things initially you can do. Don't go and wean a load of sheep, have them in a shed for half a day and stick them on a really high clover content. That's just asking for a bit of trouble. Stick them on a bit of permanent pasture for gut fill, then put them on. But even on them sort of high quality pastures, you can't tell what the animal's going to graze. There's preferential grazing in the sheep, and some of them will just hammer clover all day long and not touch anything else. So they're going to be more at risk. So actually what we're trying to sow in our mixes now, we're trying to counter that. And actually, the first few years of using Sanfoin, like, we nailed it. Like, we weren't getting any of the torsions until the back end of the year. Suddenly, they'd pick up again, and we'd have a look in the sward, and there was no Sanfoin left in it. Now, we don't use Sanfoin at all now. This part of the world, it's, we'll get it in the second year, but it's gone by the end of the second year. So we're using chicory and birds for trefoil, particularly for them, condensed tannins now. But yeah, it was a big risk growing higher quality pasture. And so, like, if everything grows quicker, but if you're killing a few of them, it's a bit annoying because it is always the top end ones that are dying. So yeah, what else, if you're going to look at including other things other than clover in your pasture, could have a big effect. But yeah, just for general management, you hear people on and off, like, it just sounds like a lot of work. Just don't put them on hungry. Just, yeah, if you've had them in a shed for a half day weaning them, stick them on something else overnight before moving them on. They're not going in and just scoffing the faces as soon as they go onto the pasture.
It was really interesting to hear from both James and Nikki, and I hope you found it as beneficial as I did. I would like to thank the British Society of Animal Science for helping us to put this podcast together. If you would like some more information on anything discussed, please visit the AHDB website, where you'll find some more information, available tools and resources. If you would like to read up on some of the research papers that have been mentioned in the podcast, please see the links in the show notes. I'm Katie Evans. Thank you for listening.
If you have any comments about this podcast or have ideas for future episodes, please email foodandfarming@ahdb.org.uk.